You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Sorry about that, everyone. I jumped the gun with my intro there, but tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary Margaret Slack toku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, everyone, and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday, the 28th of August. I'm your host, Mary Margaret, and I'm joined in studio by my producer, Justin. Hello.
Hello, Mary Margaret.
How are you today?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm a little bit sick, so I'm all right, but...
Oh, well... Well, probably the same, so busy and off with all the stuff, you know. But we got a lot of stuff talking on the show today.
Coming up on the show today, we're starting with the Green Desk to get fresh for Fashion Week, because Jack has a story about ethical fashion with the founder of the site Well Made Clothes. Justin then takes us to Australia for international news this week, and he speaks to three Australian academics about what's been happening over there. Leonard speaks to Mick Smalley about the Random Acts of Kindness Day and Splice organisation. And finally, Connor recaps Bob Mueller's investigation against the Trump administration. He aha or whakaro, get in touch with any thoughts that you have throughout the show. I'd love to hear from you. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 or YMI. Give us a call on 309 3879. But for now, let's get into the Green Desk again.
Kia tau te rangi marie, o rangi nui e tui honei, o papu tuanuku e takatonei, o te tai ao e awhinei I a tātou, tihei mauri ora. This is the Green Desk on 95BFM.
So, some of you will be aware that it is Fashion Week this week, and so my producer Jack Marshall decided to take for the Green Desk this week a story about fast fashion. He speaks to Courtney Sanders about her crusade to save us from one of the world's biggest polluters.
Now, we all know that fast food is causing problems for us around the world. Have you ever thought about the ills of fast fashion? Well, according to Forbes magazine, second to oil, the clothing and textile industry is the largest polluter in the world. Now get this, more than 150 billion garments are produced annually, enough to provide 20 new garments to every person on the planet every year. And I've got Courtney Sanders, founder of Well Made Clothes, in the studio because she's here to help us from this fashionable nightmare. So thanks for coming into the 95BFM studio. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Now, so Well Made Clothes is a marketplace, a bit like Trade Me, which consumers can purchase clothing made exclusively by ethical fashion labels. So you started Well Made Clothes after you won an innovation in journalism grant, which isn't the same thing as online fashion place. How did this journalism grant convert into an online marketplace for ethical clothing?
Yeah, it was a bit of a roundabout way to start an e-commerce marketplace, but I was working in women's interest content in Sydney at the time, and I was increasingly covering the problems with the fashion industry supply chain, particularly as they related to women, like the treatment of female garment workers, etc. Through that, I met my co-founder, Kelly Elkin, who was an ethical supply chain expert, and we decided that we wanted to create a platform that discussed these issues because they weren't getting discussed by mainstream fashion media, because arguably mainstream fashion media is the mercy of fast fashion advertisers, and so they don't talk about it very much. And we also wanted to provide a place for people to be able to shop brands if they were interested in what we were talking about. So the initial idea was quite content focused, and when we applied for that grant, it was very content focused, and then we won. And now the platform is two-pronged. So we have three editors who write daily content about the problems in the fashion industry supply chain, but the site is monetized through selling clothes at a commission. Yeah.
Oh, so you're not restricted.
No, we just wanted to do both. The fashion industry is huge and often overlooked from a kind of intellectual perspective. I think people think it's frivolous and a bit silly, and I think the mainstream fashion media quite likes to play on that in order to not cover these issues. And so we really wanted a place where if people wanted to know about what was happening, they could know about what was happening, basically make customers informed so they could make their own decisions about what they wanted to buy.
Information's power.
That's it.
And for an ethical label, ethical fashion label, to be stocked on the site, it must meet the requirements of one of the following values. It's got to be local, handcrafted, transparent, gender equality, fair, vegan, minimal waste, or sustainable? So how do you go about judging a company to see if they meet with one of these ethical values?
Yeah, so Callie Elkin, who is my co-founder, and Carly Ballard, who together they ran an industry advisory body called Clean Cut in Australia, which advised quite big fashion companies on how they could clean up their supply chains, basically. They constructed our value system. So for a label to be stocked on the site, it first has to meet our basic code of conduct, which is based on the Ethical Trading Initiative, which outlines basic human rights and basic environmental standards that they have to reach. And then on top of that, they have to meet really specific standards around at least one of our eight values. And those standards differ depending on what the value is, but they have to provide us a ton of information, and then Kelly and Carly vet their supply chain and decide whether they have the credentials to be on the site. Sometimes it's very straightforward and sometimes it's more nuanced. The big values, like for the environment, it's probably sustainable, and for human labour, it's fair. For a label to have our sustainable value, it has to have an accreditation from a independent international advisory body, whether that's got certified organic textiles, for example, which is sort of the world leading standard for certified organic textiles. Fair, they have to have an internationally fair accreditation. So sometimes it's quite specific and sometimes it's more nuanced. But yeah,
so can you actually see like on the website which one they've got as well?
Yep. So every designer page shows which values they meet, and every product shows which values it meets.
See, I went on the website and had a look around, but it's mostly girls' clothes, I think.
It's all girls' clothes.
I know. Anyway, it's
we're
not
working on it.
It's not surprising since, like, everything I'm basically wearing is either, like, secondhand or I've just had it for about 5 years and I'm not getting rid of it because that's just what we do.
That's great, though. Waste is the biggest problem in the industry. Don't throw it away.
Yeah. And then if our generation can be defined by anything, I'd say it's kind of a mixture of this distraction, extremely busy, just cell phones, etc., whatnot. You've always got to look at something, and if you're not, you've got to do something. Netflix and chill, aka. which makes well-made clothes such a wonderful idea, because you don't have to think. You just go on the website and you know you're not doing something as bad as you might otherwise. Was that kind of the thought you had going into it?
Yeah, well, the fashion industry supply chain from seed to the retail floor is so complex that it's really difficult to get on top of it. Even as an industry like expert, it's very difficult to understand the full supply chain. So we kind of wanted to break the supply chain down into bite-sized pieces and then show that consumers can kind of like pick a battle in the supply chain, that they don't have to be perfect, because it's almost impossible for either brands or consumers to be absolutely perfect. So sort of take a bite-sized chunk of this like huge problem and just be a little bit better, and that's great.
Mm-hmm. Could you also like just open up maybe a supermarket and maybe like the news in general, and just kind of, you know, make it ethical for everyone?
Then
Wouldn't
we can just
like
great?
And then we can just not think and just shop on your websites.
I know. One day.
And lastly, just for all the fashionistas out there, have you got any dope, sustainable / favorite brands out there that we should know about?
There's so many.
Which one, especially when you're, got them on your website, which one do you choose?
Yeah, so I think there's a few that I choose. We were talking about Patagonia before.
Mm-hmm.
If I want something that's like hardy and is going to last a lifetime, I choose Patagonia for like if it's like a rain jacket or something, because
nice.
They're like built to last and built for purpose with like a whole lot of ethical considerations in tow. Feel like there's a New Zealand brand, Koto, which is like leading the charge globally in terms of ethical manufacturing. They're both fair and sustainably certified. So they produce everything from certified organic cotton and fair trade premises in India. And they're amazing. And they are just going from strength to strength and their product's awesome. And then there are like local labels that I love that are producing just incredibly high quality product that you want to keep for decades, which is super important when it comes to this industry because waste is one of the biggest problems. So I have two favourite Auckland brands, Penny Sage, who is showing it Fashion Week, nice. And also Ovna Ovich. I think they both just do really beautiful product. And yeah, if I'm going to buy something special, I'll definitely buy it from them.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
Ko te White. Tēnei Marunga BFM, you are tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM. That was Jack Marshall speaking to Courtney Sanders about fast fashion, and Justin just raised with me the point that the new H&M store is opening in Britomart later this week.
Yeah,
so probably good to be mindful of that interview and the foes of fast fashion as we go through this week. So we'll be right back after this song. This is Crack Rock by Frank Ocean.
Data blind. You used to hit it raw. Cause she was and you are madly involved, madly involved. Hitting stones in glass homes. You're smoking stones in abandoned homes. You hit them stones and broke your home. Crack rock, crack rock. Crack rock, crack rock. Hitting stones in glass homes. You're smoking stones in abandoned homes. You're hitting stones and broke your home. Ooh, ooh. Crack rock, crack rock. Crack, crack, crack. You're shucking and jiving, stealing and robbing to get the fixing that you're itching for. Your family stopped inviting you to things, won't let you hold the infant. You used to get a little from time to time, but the freaks ain't trying to sleep with cracky. It's in stone. Glass homes, you're smoking stones in abandoned homes. You hit them stones and you broke your home. Crack rock, crack rock, crack rock. Cricket cap, that cap, how much dough can you push to me? Cricket cap, that cap, no good for community. Fucking picket shots, 300 men will search for me. My brother get pops, and don't no one hear the sound. Don't no one hear the rounds. Ooh, sound. Don't no one hear the shouts. Ooh, shouts. Don't no one hear the sound. Don't no one disturb the peace for riots. Don't no one disrupt Nirvana. Don't no one wanna blow the high. Crack rock. Ooh. Crack rock. Ooh. Crack rock. How you feeling, girl? Ooh. How's the gutter doing?
Crack rock.
95 BFM presents The Breeders, December 11th at the Power Station.
Should I always try?
Treasures, icons, legends, the Breeders are returning to Auckland, performing their classics and material from acclaimed new album, All Nerve. The Breeders, December 11th at the Power Station.
Tickets on sale Friday from Ticketmaster.
For Father's Day this year, give your dad the gift of rock. Or, you know, jazz, hip-hop, whatever he's into. Real Groovy Records has something for every kind of dad. Every voucher purchased this week goes in the draw to win a debut carbon turntable. Or just come in Sunday and bask in the all-day in-store dad rock. Finally, win your father's approval this Father's Day with Real Groovy, 369 Queen Street, or online at realgroovy.co.nz. Baroque Pop's Beautiful Boy is coming back down under and he's playing the hits. If you want to catch Rufus Wainwright playing tracks from his first two classic albums, then stay tuned to 95BFM for your chance to win tickets. But you've got to have a Simplicity B card. Rufus Wainwright 20th Anniversary Tour, Saturday, March 2nd at the Auckland Town Hall. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Were you at the gig on Friday?
What gig?
The Radical Maris Noise Collective. I never thought seven dudes playing saxophones would change my mind about capitalism, but hello.
That sounds
then
pretty...
2 hours of Nightcall remixes of Every Time We Touch.
What even?
And a white guy did a rap about feelings. So beautiful.
What? What?
Stay in the loop with the 95BFM Entertainment Guide. Online and on air 7 days a week, three times a day. 10:20 a.m., 3 p.m. and 6:20 p.m. It's gigs in that.
Irirangi Pōhō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. It's 20 minutes past 12. On our fast fashion story, someone's texted in to say that their friend has a label that makes bags, and you can find it at www.velvetheartbeat. So if you are more interested in looking into ethical sources for your fashion, it's a good idea. Justin, what have you got for us today?
Well, after a very messy week in Australian politics.
Yeah,
very crazy.
To the point that they're asking if they can come, if Jacinda can go over to Australia.
Yeah, I saw
that
on Twitter and just made my day. Well, back to the clip. Now, Malcolm Turnbull is being thrown out as Liberal Party leader and Prime Minister of Australia, and he's replaced by former Treasurer Scott Morrison. And what does that mean? And for that, I spoke to Dr. Peter Chin of the University of Sydney about what caused the leadership challenge and how it will affect Trans-Tasman relations. Then I'll speak to Dr. Jill Shepherd of the Australia National University to talk about how Scott Morrison's new government can affect refugee or climate change policies. And finally, I talked to Frank Bongiorno, also of the ANU, to talk about this, the last week's legacy on Australian political history. But first, I have asked Dr. Peter Chin to answer what the thing that's on our minds for the past week. What is going on?
Basically, the short story is that the ruling party, the Liberal Party of Australia, they have increasingly, over the last couple of decades, started to drift into two competing camps, really around the more traditional liberals who are associated with classical liberalism and modern conservatism that is kind of similar to what we see coming out of the United States. And so internally they have a great deal of difficulties basically working together. And that has turned into a number of personality conflicts. And those personality conflicts have led to poor governmental performance. And because of poor governmental performance, the government's been polling very poorly, and that has precipitated the leadership transition that's occurred.
Now, Scott Morrison is the Prime Minister of Australia. Do you think he will have different policies on New Zealanders in Australia?
There's a possibility that might change. I think a really open question. I think there will be some moderation of that policy. But if New Zealanders are hoping for a complete reversal of Australia's policies with regards to both, New Zealand citizens have been convicted of crimes in Australia and their detention and deportation, but also the standing of New Zealand citizens in Australia with regards to, say, welfare and access to permanent residency and citizenship. I think it's unlikely there will be substantial changes. Those policies have actually have a really long history. in Australia, going back some decades now. And unfortunately for New Zealanders, that while there's actually a large number of New Zealanders living in Australia, they're an extremely large cultural group in Australia. Australians actually pay no attention at all to what goes on in New Zealand, nor really cares about New Zealand politics or the concerns of the New Zealand government. And to give you an illustration of that, 29%, almost a third of Australians, can't actually name New Zealand when asked to list countries in the region.
What are your thoughts on the Trans-Tasman relationship under Morrison?
Well, I think it's likely to continue relatively unchanged. The Trans-Tasman relationship is quite robust, it's strong, it's institutionalised in many ways. So if you think about all those Trans-Tasman governing institutions like standard-making body and various trade organisations and things like that, they are really tied into the kind of heart of the structure of the diplomatic relations between the two countries. Those things aren't going to change. And changes in Australian government and leadership don't substantially influence the Trans-Tasman relationship in many ways. Sometimes there are stronger and weaker relationships between the two countries. So, for example, John Key and Malcolm Turnbull had quite a close relationship. And that's partly because they were basically the same person, you know, sort of rich businessmen, white dudes kind of thing, like to wear a lot of suits. But that was sort of maybe a slightly higher watermark than the average relationship. And generally speaking, Australia and New Zealand see the world in similar ways. They have relatively highly integrated economies that are facilitated by a large set of standing governance arrangements. And the areas of disputation tend to be about the treatment of expatriate New Zealanders in Australia. And that really hasn't substantially changed in 20 years.
When Scott Morrison is immigration minister, he has a quite strong policy on immigration. Do you think under his administration, will this change for the good or the other way?
Yeah, look, I think Scott Morrison as Prime Minister probably won't be looking to change too much at the moment. So currently Australia has quite strict border control and immigration policies. I don't think there's any sign of that changing under the new leadership of the Australian government. What I think is interesting though about Scott Morrison is that even though he has been incredibly tough on immigration, particularly on asylum seekers who arrive by boat, he hasn't made that central to his political persona. So in a way, like someone like Peter Dutton talked a lot about how tough and strict he was on immigration, Scott Morrison sort of did it more quietly. So we might see a little bit of tinkering around the edge, but for the most part, I don't think much will change.
What about on climate change?
Scott Morrison will be more conservative than the previous Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, on issues like climate change. But what we saw and what was so important in bringing down Malcolm Turnbull's Prime Ministership is the majority of the current Liberal Party, even those on the backbench, don't think that we need to act on climate change, and so whoever is Prime Minister is going to be hamstrung by that majority opinion. So I don't think either way, even if Scott Morrison was particularly progressive on climate change, that we would see any difference there.
But will that have any effect on Australia's place in the Paris Climate Change Agreement?
Yeah, look, it wouldn't surprise me if Scott Morrison did move to withdraw Australia from the Paris Agreement on climate change. I think that is majority position of his parliamentary colleagues in the Liberal Party. And also, Scott Morrison has been an unabashed supporter of the coal industry in Australia. And so what we're seeing from the Liberal Party at the moment, really interestingly, is not just people questioning, I guess, climate change science, but being really proactively supportive of the coal industry. And that's probably where the government will head under Scott Morrison, even further in favour of supporting coal-fired power stations.
What does this mean for Australian politics in the future?
Hopefully we'll see an end to this relatively constant turnover of prime ministers in Australia. The important thing to remember about the Australian political system is that underlying all of this personnel turnover, that we're really quite stable. There's relatively high rates of trust and satisfaction in Australian politics. These are on fairly rapid decline, but still, as we go internationally, Australia's political system is incredibly stable. So hopefully we'll put an end to this, but that remains to be seen. I think given how unpopular this particular leadership change is likely to be with the Australian people, and we've already seen opinion polls out this morning that suggest Australian voters are incredibly unhappy with the Liberal Party for doing this. Hopefully both major parties in future will see that it's not, this kind of behaviour is not without negative consequence, that voters will punish them. I also think what we'll see at the next election is the minor parties getting record high vote share. I think Australian voters are increasingly turned off both major parties. With our preferential voting system, votes tend to go back to the major parties anyway, so we probably won't see seats really change. Both of the major parties remain in pretty tight control of the government generally, but I think more people will give their first preference vote to minor party and independent candidates, and eventually the major parties are going to have to listen to that and probably fix their behaviour.
Why does this frequency exist in Australian politics?
There are a lot of theories about why it's happened. I think in the Australian case, the almost complete sovereignty of the parliamentary party, its capacity to make and break leaders, is a very powerful phenomenon. I mean, in most Anglo democracies now, I think party leaders, there are rules that to some extent insulate them from that kind of sort of internal parliamentary party overthrow, usually some form of rank and file selection, which Canada for some parties, or at least one of the political parties, goes all the way back to the First World War. This isn't the case in Australia, and it means that when things turn bad, or there's a perception that things are going bad for a political leader, usually via opinion polling, which in itself has become much more frequent over the last 20 or 25 years, parliamentary parties are very tempted to replace a leader. So persistent poor performance, or a perception of poor performance, is, you know, can be enough for a leader to be destabilised. So I think that's one of the factors. I mean, some people would point to the, you know, increasing scrutiny with 24/7 media. They point to perhaps the role of social media in providing a particularly kind of hothouse environment. So it's clear there have been changes in recent years that have perhaps made for greater instability. But there are also, I think, some quite, as I said, deep structural peculiarities of the Australian system. It is interesting, for instance, that after Kevin Rudd came back to the Prime Ministership for his second run back in 2013, he managed to get through the party some rule changes that actually make it very difficult now for a Labor Party leader to be replaced between elections. And indeed, a system of rank and file membership voting was introduced. And it's striking that Bill Shorten has now survived about 5 years as Labor Party leader, despite occasional rumblings from rivals and rumblings about his performance from time to time. Those rule changes 5 years ago seem to have provided a degree of stability that's missing in the case of the Liberal Party.
Comparing to previous leadership challenges, are there differences, or are they basically the same?
Each sort of has its own, I guess, dynamics and peculiarities. A common pattern, I think, has been for an initial unsuccessful tilt at the leadership by an individual, but they get close enough, or even when they don't get that close, that is such a destabilising act that a second attempt down the road, usually some months later, is successful. And that's happened on a number of occasions. It happened when Paul Keating, for instance, eventually overcame Bob Hawke in 1991. I mean, he'd had an initial unsuccessful tilt in mid-1991 and then was successful by 5 votes at the end of 1991. Incidentally, exactly the same margin as we've seen Scott Morrison beat Peter Dutton in the last few days. So, yeah, there have been some patterns that have recurred, but they each have their own dynamic. I mean, this one was a particularly messy one, I think, not least because of the state of the House of Representatives, the lower house itself, where the parties are very finely balanced. The government is a majority government, but only just. And there were a couple of parliamentary votes on the floor of the House last week where the margins were very close indeed. One vote in one instance, and indeed the government's successful attempt to actually adjourn the parliament a couple of weeks only passed by 2 votes. So I think that's given a particular complexion to this challenge, or it's one of the factors that have made this one perhaps, I think, a much messier one. But there are also a number of other issues that have come into play this time round. I mean, I think this particular battle of the last few days has been perceived by some of those involved at least as a kind of battle for the soul of the Liberal Party. So there's at least a perception that they're kind of philosophical differences that are actually being fought out here. Whereas I don't think that was the case with the Rudd-Gillard rivalry within the Labor Party. That was much more about personality and power. Those things are clearly operating here, but I think there is also a sense that of philosophical difference, and obviously a lot of the destabilisation of Turnbull's leadership came from the right of the party, who see him as not one of them, who see him as too far left, as pursuing policies and having a temperament, if you like, that's more in tune with the Labour Party than the Liberal Party.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
That was Justin speaking to Peter Chin, Gillian Sanders and... Oh, Jill Shepherd, sorry, and Frank Bongiorno. That was great.
Yeah, and we just got some updates overnight because Malcolm Turnbull has said he will resign from Parliament this week, and that means the ruling coalition between Liberal and National are one seat short of a majority in the lower house. Then what does that mean? It means Scott Morrison needs support from crossbenchers to survive until his seat in East Sydney is filled. And that...
Do you think he'll get that support?
It depends, because some... Because I have lots of speculation before the leadership challenges are pointing towards Peter Dutton becoming the Prime Minister, and quite a lot of crossbenchers are not really on Peter Dutton's conservative side.
But regardless of who it is, I'm sure they would be a bit sick of all the changes by this point.
Yeah, it'll probably be that. So if the coalition can't get the crossbenchers to protect them throughout until, I reckon, October for the by-election, they will be very vulnerable. And if especially Bill Shorten's Labour Party is gaining on the momentum in the polls, and they can fling a confidence of no motion anytime. But yeah, the last thing I just want to talk about is last week we saw the real brutality of politics, because only 2 days before Malcolm Turnbull is thrown out, Scott Morrison at a press conference actually put his arm around Malcolm Turnbull and said, and I quote, "This is my leader and I'm ambitious for him." And 2 days later, Turnbull is out, Morrison is in.
It's volatile.
Very volatile. And yeah, and I just really hoped this can stop for a while.
Absolutely. Interesting. Let us know your thoughts on 5395. But now, Leonard spoke to Mick Smalley of the Splice organisation this morning about Random Acts of Kindness Day. On Friday, they will be handing out pots of honey on Queen Street. So Leonard found out why.
All right, I'm here. I'm sitting in studio today with Mick from Splice. Is it just Splice? Is that the name of it?
Splice Courage and Compassion Community. We've thrown an extra strapline on there now because people don't quite get it.
Yeah.
And it's about kind of connecting the threads of the community to create strength. So it's splicing like the nautical sense. We're out there, we're a small community development team in the city centre neighbourhood, what used to be known as the CBD. And our role is really about kind of responding to the fact that there's a whole lot more people living here now. You know, there's 55,000 people living permanently within the ring of the motorway system. Not a lot of social infrastructure, years of being a CBD, business and tertiary focus. So supporting people to do their own thing. Had a guy the other day came to us, wanted to be able to practice a Swiss horn. He was kind of discovering that playing a Swiss horn in an apartment kind of wasn't the done thing. People coming to us all the time with all sorts of things. We Tai Chi groups, yoga play groups for parents with under fives, pretty anarchic thing.
You were saying you're at Tai Chi this morning in the park.
Yeah. So I do Tai Chi quite regularly. That's just a one-on-one session that I do with the teacher. But we have a Tai Chi class down at the Ellen Melville Centre on Thursdays in the evenings at 5:30. It's just local residents and workers coming together to, you know, wave hands like clouds and all that kind of stuff.
So Splice is based, it's particularly for the CBD?
Yeah, it's mostly the CBD. We are doing a little bit of branch out into the regions now too, up sort of some stuff that's going to be happening in Kaitaia and a few other places. Yeah, so connecting people, knowing what's going down, a bit of advocacy work around public spaces with an urban planning students class from University of Auckland. We've got a program called Active Citizens that's being played out. It's actually a British Council program that we're partnering with them, which is really just about encouraging people to kind of be active in community.
Well, you're in today in particular to talk about the Random Acts of Kindness Day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just tell the listeners a little bit about what they can expect from that.
So, Random Acts of Kindness Day, Saturday, 1st of September every year. We're actually going out on Friday to kind of get people in the mood for Saturday. So a number of things are going to be happening around town. For us, it is, we'll be hitting Queen Street with 5,000 little jars of honey, little wow. pots of kindness, and a kindness card, just to kind of, you know, kindness is a contagious thing. You know, we figure that if we start the ball rolling, a little pot of honey, our hope is that instigates the next kind of round of kindness, and it just kind of keeps rippling out through the community. So that's what we're doing. We've got a few cafes around town. If you go to your regular, you might discover that they're one of them who are giving out free coffees with a kindness card as well. And Metro New World are in on board this year as well, doing stuff in store. And they're doing coffees as well, actually. Gold coin donation at their coffee kiosk. All that money is going towards the community fridge. For feeding the streeties and so on in Victoria, Wellesley Street.
Right, is that the one, it's up near the Sky Tower? Is it through the dip up the other side of Wellesley?
Yeah, it's where the train station, actually, entrance is going to be. So it's a Pārongaronga, will be the other name,